Aussies only. Thanks to GLG Green Life Group, leaders in property services and open space management at glgcorp.com.
Hello and welcome to Aussies Only, your podcast on the First Serve Network, diving deep into the world of Australian tennis. It is your host, Jed Zetzer, with you today, and we've got a mega edition of the show. I'm joined by Nathan Healy, and we're going to dive deep into Nathan's journey from becoming a pro player to becoming a pro coach on the tour to founding PlayAwake. Well, I'm not going to keep you waiting any longer. We're going to dive straight into Nathan's journey. Nathan, thank you so much for joining us on Aussies Only.
Yeah, no worries, Jed. It's great to meet you via Zoom, and glad we could connect. Not easy with the time zones.
It's not. Well, we'll get into, you know, the fact that you're living in America at the moment shortly, but before we do, I want to sort of start off with your life before we get into your tennis. Born on the Central Coast, can you tell us a little bit about your upbringing?
Sure, Central Coast, 1 hour north of Sydney. Basically grew up at a tennis club with 23 courts, running around in nappies. And my grandparents ran the center, and then followed by my parents. And yeah, I was in the family for like 23 years. And full of fun around the courts, very much sporting family, with obviously tennis, but soccer and athletics. I have two brothers who are also very, very keen tennis players. I guess I was the one that was a little bit more determined to follow it through and go through the hard yards. And took off in Australian touring teams at age 14 and turned pro at 17. And then was on tour for 12 years. So it's quite a journey.
So you were born basically into the world of tennis. It came to you very early. Do you remember the first time you picked up a racket, or was that just, were you born with a racket in your hand?
I was actually a little later than most professional players. I was involved in soccer and athletics, but it was really nine years of age a student of my father's, so my dad was coaching at the club, he put a racket in my hand, and I began hitting against a wall. And I had a blast, and that's when I said to Dad, "Hey, I'd like to give this a go." And he was like, "All right," because he never pushed myself or my brothers into it. He was waiting for us to, be bitten by the bug. And yeah, that happened for me at nine. And yeah, so then it was obviously hours and hours of extra time on the court for him. That's when it took off.
So nine, as you mentioned, it is a little bit later than probably most who end up becoming pro. When did you first realize that you were actually better than just the average kid? And when did you first sort of think, all right, actually, I want to become a pro?
I guess it was under 12s. So I remember going to the Canberra Nationals, and I was chosen in the New South Wales state team. So there were three of us chosen in that team. I made the round of 16 there, and then New South Wales actually won the tour, team event. It was nationals first, the tournament first, and then the team event followed. And it was there that I guess I was touched with, the feelings of, the first feelings of winning a state title. It felt great, and it was a natural fit with the family, and they were all excited by it. So I figured, why not follow this through?
Yeah, that's awesome. And what was your relationship like with tennis as a junior? Was it like you loved the sport and you just wanted to play as much as possible, or was it that you were really good at it? And I guess that was the reason you were playing.
I guess it was a bit of both. I was good at it, and I was also just loving it. But I had that determination to just train my butt off. I run through brick walls. I'd always come off the court all bloodied up, and I'd be diving all over the place, and on clay courts covered in clay. And yeah, I definitely had the work ethic, and yeah, was willing to go that extra mile.
So, for sure, yeah. For sure. And just sort of fast forwarding a couple of years. 2006 was the year that, I looked at your career and that stood out to me on paper. That was quite a number of years into your career. Can you tell us a little bit about, and we will touch on that year, but can you tell us a little bit about the first couple of years in your career and what led to you eventually cracking the top 200 and winning a couple rounds at the Australian Open?
I actually had some knee injuries towards the end of my junior career, and it was a struggle to really attack the singles court. It was a lot easier to be on the doubles court for the knees, so they were able to handle doubles. Obviously, it's not as physical, and I ended up doing really well quite quickly, and so my ranking shot up. I started making money. And it was with actually Paul Hanley, who he went on to top 10 in the world. But each year we were halving our ranking. So it was like 800, 400, 200, 100. And, and eventually, it was probably quicker than that. But it was a pretty quick trajectory to winning Sydney with him and reaching like 55 in the world. And, when I think it was 2000, 2004, I was 24 when the ATP changed the rules and they allowed singles players to use their rankings as doubles rankings. So in that year that the cutoffs became really challenging, and I was just missing cuts, and it got a little bit frustrating. Paul went off and played a little bit with Wayne Arthurs, and his ranking jumped ahead of mine, and he was in some of the bigger events where I was just missing out. So I decided at 24 to have a run at singles, and that meant starting again from scratch. So back to the futures, and got those through those relatively quickly up into challenges, and then my wife would like to say she was the reason, I made third round of that Australian Open in 2006. And yes, sure, she had a bit to do with it. Maybe I, became a little bit more stable mentally. I just started to put the game together a little bit more. I still say now that I really didn't know how to play the game. Looking back, I would have done things a little bit differently, but it was a I physically was in amazing shape by then, I was confident coming out of Sydney International. I had a win over I'm blanking on his name, but we can look that up. I played a good match against James Blake in Sydney, and then went to Melbourne and beat the Italian player Filippo Volandri. He was 26 in the world, and then Amir Delic, and then lost a tight match to Nikolai Davydenko, which is one of my favourite memories from the tour for sure.
Yeah, so I was going to say that was a really tight match with Davydenko. I think it was 7-5 in the fourth. So I was looking at, the trajectory was a lot of doubles, and your doubles ranking, as you mentioned, it skyrocketed quite quickly to inside the top 60, and, winning three titles with, I think it was two with Paul and one with Justin Gimelstob, an incredible doubles career to go up that quickly. And then, as you mentioned, to switch over to the singles court and give it a crack as well. How difficult was it after reaching the third round of the Australian Open? I'm sure there was a lot of expectation that was put on your shoulders. How difficult was that to actually play with? Because I'm sure before that Australian Open campaign, there wasn't that expectation?
Yeah, that's true. So after the Australian Open, I went to Burnie Challenger and I won that tournament, and which was a great turnaround and another shot of confidence for the year ahead. But then I went to the States and just got a little bit lost. I feel like being in the Australian environment is always a great place for Australia players to start the year. You know, you're used to the climate, you know, you have the fans, and I really fed off that environment. And then going to a challenger and a cold climate indoors, just, you know, there was a string of tournaments that were just so different. And yeah, so I lost a few first rounds. Then I struggled with a couple of injuries, and all of a sudden that confidence that was, you know, really born at the start of the year, which dissipated. And yeah, it was challenging to find the flow again. Yeah, so I guess I got down to, I'm not sure of the exact timeline, but yeah, got down to 158. But yeah, just was couldn't find that flow again.
Yeah, it is very difficult, I'm sure, you know, playing in front of a home crowd and then sort of going onto the Challenger Tour overseas and playing in front of a small crowd. And as you mentioned, it's cold, it's indoors, it's basically the complete opposite conditions. Do you feel though that you having gone through those experiences has helped you become a better coach post your playing career? Obviously you went into coaching, which we'll get onto in a sec, but has that helped you in your coaching career?
Without a doubt. You know, I always, when I do reflect on my career as a player, I feel like I left a few stones unturned. As I say to the players that I work with, I if I did it differently, I'd reach out to mentors. I'd really seek advice of players and that had been there before. And I really didn't reach out for the assistance that was available if I actually looked. And yeah, and with that, I think I would have been able to construct points a little better. And yeah, just find a deeper understanding of the game. And I guess that's what I can talk about with coaching, is that once I put the coach's hat on, I actually for sure became a better player. And yeah, that's what I encourage a lot of the kids that I work with, is to actually coach each other. And yeah, you start to see the court differently for sure.
We've spoken about that run, that famous run at the 2006 Australian Open, but your career was full of other memories as well. And I want to touch on one, the World Team Tennis. You competed in that tournament and you played alongside some of the biggest names in the history of the game. Do you mind sort of diving into that journey and talking to us a bit about who were some of the names that you played with and against, and just how was that experience overall?
Yeah, no, it's an incredible experience, the World Team Tennis. It's very rare that we get a chance to be, you know, in a team, and especially with women players. So it's a mixed team event with two men and two women on each team. Some teams have a few extras as subs, but generally, yeah, you have four players. And yeah, I got to play with against Boris Becker, David Wheaton, Serena Williams. I played against Serena. I was playing with Venus Williams against Serena and Justin Gimbelstob. And yeah, with some of my favorite memories though, with John McEnroe. He was making fun of my ball toss. I'd sort of start to lose the ball toss occasionally, and he's turned to the crowd and make a big scene about it. Yeah, it was a great experience to play against him in singles, also in doubles. I played with Bjorn Borg against him, and I can't remember the other player he was playing with, but I remember after the match sitting in the player lounge with Borg and McEnroe and just thinking, wow, this is a special moment that a lot of people would kill for. So yeah, those memories stick with me. Yeah, that's for sure. And also playing with Martina Navratilova. Yeah, they're yeah, she's an amazing woman. And Billie Jean King was running the league. You know, she was the one that created it. So she was she owned the team that I was on with the Philadelphia Freedoms. And yeah, it's very popular over here in the States.
Yeah, it sounds incredible. The whole concept, and just sort of having the opportunity to mix with some of those people, I guess behind the scenes, like just in the player locker rooms in the area. How was it? And is there any sort of memory that may stand out to you? I mean, it's difficult to remember these sort of things, but anything that might stand out that you remember that happened behind the scenes, like if any of these guys were, you know, funny in particular or made some outlandish calls.
One of my favorite memories was playing with Andre Agassi. That was awesome. You know, and just witnessing him return serve and the way he locked his eyes on the ball. His eyes were just so big and just glued to that ball. So, you know, I learned a lot there. He's just good energy on the bench as well. Who else? I guess traveling with Venus Williams, very humble, traveled with the team on the commercial planes where she could have obviously flown prior. But she also had her dog with her. So that memory sticks out as well. Martina Navratilova, she had a quirk with the bag tags. She needed all the tags off the bags immediately after we landed in one of That's the cities, as well as she needed her Evian water.
That is so I awesome. Thought
that was funny. She ordered that, so that had to be sitting in her room when she arrived at the hotel. I guess all players, you know, have some kind of quirk or OCD.
For sure. Yeah. Did you, in your playing days, and even now, I mean, when you're out on the court, do you have any little quirks or superstitions that you go by?
I don't like to step on lines. I sort of take note of that.
Yeah.
Nothing really that's except my rackets, I guess they needed to be, you know, identical weights and balances. I could feel the racket if it was a pound out here and there, as well as string tension. I could feel that. So yeah, I was a little pedantic about the rackets. But other than that, there's nothing else that sticks out for me. There was a player that I did play at Wimbledon, Kenneth Carlson, where I was told before the match, as he warms up his serve, he has to serve on the juice side. So he makes sure he gets to the net to warm up his volleys first, so then his opponent's second. And then it's just one of his, you know, his superstition. So I actually got to the net second. He beat me to the net. So after I finished volleying, I went quickly back to the baseline and all of a sudden a ball came straight past my head. That stood out with Kenneth, as well as he looks at his target. So I don't know whether, I guess he's not going to hear, he's retired now. But he looked at where he was serving. So, you know, for all young players out there, keep an eye on the player's eyes as they're stepping up to serve. You might get a hint on where they're going.
Yeah, that's brilliant. That's so interesting. As you mentioned, every player and every person has their specific, you know, quirk, and that's a really interesting one that I've never heard of. Now, Nathan, you played against arguably the greatest player of all time as a junior. You came up against Roger Federer and you got the win. You're 1-0 against the Swiss maestro. Can you tell us a bit about that whole experience? I mean, you were younger. It must be difficult to remember, but does anything sort of stand out from that time playing against Roger as a junior? And could you have possibly known back then that, wow, this kid's going to be good?
Well, I did. Yeah, this is one memory that is firmly etched in my mind. A lot of pro players dismiss this. because it didn't happen in, you know, in seniors. But yeah, as a junior, it happened in Davos, Switzerland. I was traveling with a touring team. I was with Darren Cahill. He was the coach. And a good mate of his was coaching Roger at the time, Peter Carter. And yeah, I can picture the court. I can picture the match. And yeah, I came away with a win 6-4 in the third. And yeah, 1-0 against him is quite special. You know, Peter had, you know, he did a great job with his strokes. He did look like he had, you know, the technique to go on and do something great in the sport, but to do what he's done, no, I couldn't, you know, couldn't pick it back then. Otherwise, I guess I would have been, you know, also in the mix to do something like he's done. But yeah, that was a special trip. I love Switzerland. It's a gorgeous place. And, you know, in the Swiss Alps and Davos, it's, yeah, quite, I think the junior tournament's still running there. But yeah, it was a great time. Leighton Hewitt was on the trip with us as well. Yeah, I'm not sure how he did in that event, but yeah, playing against Rog, it's special. And he remembers it. He has great memory of all the matches he plays. So yeah, it's cool.
That's awesome. Have you ever spoken to Rog since then? Have you ever bumped into him in the locker rooms or just behind the scenes and had a quick comment to him? Yep, 1-0. Got that one on you.
Yeah, I think I ran into him at the US Open a couple of years ago when I was with Max. And yeah, he was just arriving. And yeah, as soon as he walked in, he's super present with whoever he talks to. And that's what stood out with him. You know, he had so much going on around him. Everyone's, you know, excited to see Rogers just arrived at Flushing Meadows. But he was definitely locked in conversation with me. You know, and I remember asking him a question about his mental, you know, and how, you know, his mental approach to the game and who he worked with. And, you know, it just felt like he had a secret there that he didn't want to tell. But it was definitely something that he worked on, specifically when Peter Carter passed in South Africa in an accident over there. Yeah, I think it was a devastating time, and it wasn't long after that is when his career really took off. So, yeah. But, yeah, he always has time. I mean, he looks like he has so much time on the court, but off the court as well.
Nathan, you came up against some big players, especially on the doubles court. I'm sure none bigger than the serve of Andy Roddick. Do you mind telling us about how it was facing his serve and how difficult it was facing his serve?
Yeah, it's one of the, yeah, definitely the heaviest serve that I've ever faced, and it was on grass. It was at Surbiton. It was a challenger tournament leading into...
Wow.
Queens and Wimbledon. He was there, you know, as a practice match. He played with Robbie Ginepri, former semi-finalist of the US Open. And I was playing with Chris Guccione, and we ended up getting him in three sets. I remember he rocked up the court with two rackets, so it really was a practice outing for him. And it was, you know, it was big for Chris and I. So it was nice to get that win. And yeah, it's a difficult serve to pick, but we did break him for the match. So, you know, it was nice to take that one.
Absolutely. Can you sort of touch on now how you made that transition from playing to coaching? Was that something that you always dreamed of doing? Was it possibly an opportunity that came up that gave you a bit of a push in the right direction? How did you, yeah, make that transition from playing to coaching?
It happened quite abruptly. As a player, I always said to my father, who I mentioned as a coach, I said I'd never coach, and I was very stubborn with that. And it was 2008, and I'd been plagued with injuries, a groin injury that I just couldn't shake. I had a daughter that was on her way into the world. So my wife was, what was she? What is that? 8 months pregnant. And Leighton Hewitt asked me to come away with him. And so essentially my wife had the baby in January, and a week later I was off with Leighton. and we linked up in the Bahamas. We had a week training there, and then over to San Jose and Memphis. And knowing Leighton growing up, we have that immediate rapport. He had enormous respect for me, which was surprising. I felt like I was going over to be more of a hitting partner. But it was, you know, I put the coach's hat on, I dove into that role, and we clicked, and he made two semifinals. And after that, he said, "That's it. I want you with me." So it was like, all right, well, you know, I have this newborn baby. This would be a logical move forward for myself and the family.
Absolutely. So you're with Leighton for a year. Can you just, how challenging was that year? How challenging, how amazing, what were sort of the feelings that you were going through in that year with Leighton?
Well, as I said, we really clicked as a team. He really fed off my energy. He was outside 100 or right around 100 when we began. And back into the top 20, but we were together about a year and a half. And one of the favorite memories was him being with him when he beat Federer in Halle. So he lost 15 times, and he played him in that final, and it's a final I'll never forget. And I'm quite emotional about it, actually. It was, you know, he beat him 6 in the third. We really, you know, when he was out there, we locked eyes, and I felt like the energy that I brought to that box, he just took on, and he trusted what I had to say. And it worked. I really thought he'd go on to win Wimbledon that year. He was primed to do it. He lost to Djokovic. And it was, but he played a great match. And yeah, he's a special Australian player, big heart, and, you know, loves the sport. And yeah, it was a pleasure to be part of that journey with him.
Yeah, I remember watching that match on the couch here at home in Melbourne. That is still, it's probably one of my earliest memories watching tennis. Definitely one that will not, that I will not forget. So you coached Leighton for a little while. And when you look back at your career, how does that stand out with you that time, and how do you reflect on it?
Well, as I mentioned, we, you know, have a history throughout juniors. So we had that mutual respect for each other. Leighton, you know, he's always very focused, very organized, very professional. What stands out now, reflecting on it, is that he was the boss off the court, but when we were on the court, he gave up those reins. He stepped in as the student, and he allowed me to coach him, which I think is remarkable. And I think that's a challenge for a lot of players. As their tendency is when they become the employer, it's not easy to take that hat off when you're on the court. So, you know, and then as soon as that happens, that, you know, they stop listening and they stop growing, stop evolving. Leighton did that extremely well. So, it was a pleasure to work with him. Energetically, he really fed off me in the box, and he really had an uncanny ability, as we know, to draw off the crowd and the environment around him. And that's something that I feel like can be learned, but it's there's an art to it. He was a master
for sure. And do you still stay in touch with Leighton? What's the relationship like these days?
The relationship's great. I mean, there will always be that mutual respect. He's, you know, he's a legend. And we haven't been in touch recently, but I'll be back in Australia soon. And hopefully he lives in Sydney now. So hopefully we get a chance to hang out again. I'd love to get out on the golf course with him. I mean, we played a lot in the Bahamas, and That was some very fond memories of he's a very good golfer, so he takes me down there. But I'd love to hang out with him again, and he has a lovely family and kids are great. He's a wonderful father, he really is, and Beck's amazing. To spend some more time with him would be great.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'm sure when you get back to Australia, for sure you'll hit the golf course with him. So you finish up with Leighton. Can you fill in the gap for sort of that 5 to 10 year period between then and now, and what you've been up to, and where your coaching has taken you?
Sure. Yeah. So my wife is from outside of Philadelphia in Pennsylvania, about 2 hours from New York, and it made sense while I was traveling with Leighton, which was, you know, like 40 weeks out of the year. It made sense that she was near me because we were based in the Bahamas. So she traveled there a little bit. And so when I finished, it was a natural transition just to go back to Pennsylvania. And so, you know, at the time, it was challenging for me to leave Leighton. But I did have a 2-year-old, and it was time for me to be spending a bit more time with them. So I came back to Pennsylvania, started private coaching, and I was also playing myself a little bit and winning a lot of the money tournaments in the area. So I was enjoying that, you know, playing and coaching and, you know, putting into practice what I'd learned when I was with Leighton. And as I said, I started to see the court so much clearer, as well as bringing in yoga and other mental techniques, meditation. And yeah, I really started to go down those rabbit holes, which just made me a better person and definitely more wise. And it was really fun to put that into practice. And that's where my whole theory or concept of play awake was born. And that's what I'm really, you know, super passionate about, bringing the holistic approach to the court and life. So that's 2010 through 2012. And then I ended up at a country club. So I spent 5 years at a country club in Westchester, Pennsylvania.
Amazing. So can you touched on Play Awake. I was going to ask you about that. How do the techniques and the methods you use equip someone to be a better player on the court? Because I think it's evident that the players you've worked with, you can see a serious mental shift in the way that they approach their tennis. How does it equip you to become a better player on the court?
Yeah. So Play Awake is something that I'm super passionate about. And it's a holistic approach that allows the player to bring their entire self to the court without it. It undoes any stresses and anything that's causing anxiety off the court. It's clearing those blocks, which allows the player to step on the court, to be fearless, to play with their heart, to really show up, without that anxiety, and therefore have the ability to play, and not be focused on the score and the storyline of making money and everything that comes from winning tennis matches. So it allows you to play in the moment. You know, we use it all the time. It's so cliche, you know, to be in the moment, but it's very hard to be in the moment when you've got stories running through your mind of what this match means, and if I win this, I will go on and to this round, and then I'll make this money, and so, you know, and this, you know, my parents will respect me and my friends and my peers. So it really quiets those stories and allows the player to show up fully and like I said, fearlessly.
Absolutely. And it's evident that it works, because I guess the latest player that you've worked with, Max Purcell, I've obviously followed Max's career very closely, and it's incredible just how many situations on the court he's been able to get himself out of when you look at the scoreboard. I mean, last year there was a string of matches where, you know, the average player would just have lost simply because they were in trouble on the scoreboard, and Max managed to dig himself out of those holes. Play awake. You sort of mentioned how it allows you, I guess, to turn a blind eye in a way to the scoreboard and not have that pressure impact your game. How important can that be for a player? Obviously, Max won so many games literally just off that. How important is it?
Well, we say that this sport is what, 90% mental. You know, a lot of players would agree with that. But I you know, being on tour, I look around at what players are actually doing, and I don't really see them working on that side of the game. There is so much hitting balls and so much on-court time and physical, but I feel like that this piece is missing with a lot of players. And so, yeah, I think it's extremely important. And Max really took to it. He really dove in and trusted the process that I bring to the table. And yeah, he cleared a lot of mental blocks that would have really inhibited his growth on the court and the results on the court, but his growth as a person. And that's what I'm most proud of, is him as a person. He definitely grew from it. I'm super proud of him.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you look at, I guess, his run last year, it all started in Eastbourne, and that run could have easily not eventuated if he didn't, you know, come back from a massive deficit in the first round. And, you know, it's amazing to see, you know, he was on the court and he was in some difficult, tricky positions, and the way he just navigated his way out of it. Do you think that is possibly the most valuable, I guess, asset to come out of Play Awake, is that a player on the court can literally just navigate their way out of difficult spots simply because they're not dwelling on it and not focusing on it so much?
Yeah, as I said, you know, the process, he was able to really go through a mental process between points and at the change of ends. And yeah, and that's what part of the teaching is about as well. It is doing the off-court work and working on stresses that are happening off the court, but then also on the court, having clear mental processes to go through. And I mean, him coming to me, he always had an uncanny ability to find his way out of difficult situations, but I think the Play Awake process has definitely added tools to his repertoire and simplified things for him mentally. So watching him in Eastbourne, watching him at the Olympics, I mean, it was beautiful to watch, and I'm super proud. It's a pleasure to be part of his journey as well.
Absolutely. And Nathan, so you're now in the States. Can you tell us a little bit about your year so far and your plans for the future? What's in store?
Well, the future is, I'm curious about what's going to happen next. Unfortunately, Max and I ended. It was challenging to end our partnership, but you know, everything happens and has its timeline. So I'm here in Pennsylvania and waiting to see what happens next. I'm in loving time with the family though, so really appreciating being with my two kids who are now 10 and 13, and time with my wife and her family. And I don't know if you can see this guy behind me, but that's a body combat bag. Or his name's Bob. He's called Bob. Body opponent bag. Anyway, it's for kickboxing, and my 13-year-old's really into that. And so I'm working with her on that and learning a few things myself. So I'm just, you know, I'm open to whatever comes. There is something on the horizon to do with mental health, which is a Madison Keys event out in Iowa. It's called the Court of Dreams. There was a segment last year during Wimbledon. Essentially, a guy named Michael Kuhn created a court in the middle of a cornfield. So we've heard of the Field of Dreams, I assume. the baseball movie. So yeah, he had the idea to create this court back in 2003, and yeah, he's invited college teams and yeah, tons of players since 2003. Unfortunately, his son committed suicide in 2016 after they'd visited Wimbledon together. And so, obviously, that was extremely, shocking for him. And but his plan with his son was to lay actual Wimbledon grass, which is called rye grass, I believe. So after this happened, he decided to lay the court himself and dedicated it to his son Alex. And so I'm headed out there in the middle of July. For this charity event, and obviously, and Play Awake is also all about, it's about the person, it's about the human first before the athlete. And so, yeah, that's really close to my heart. And yeah, to be with, be with Madison and take part in such an event is exciting for me. And we'll see what comes from that. And yeah, but I'm just here to support anyone that needs assistance, and
curious. It sounds like an incredible story, and I'd be keen. You got to send some photos through when you're there. I'd be keen to see the court. It sounds amazing.
Well, look it up online. The documentary's there, Court of Dreams, Wimbledon, and it's like a 10-minute video. And it's, pretty cool what this guy did.
Nathan, so just looking at your recent coaching, Chris, we spoke about, you worked with Max and the relationship now has ended in terms of a coaching relationship. Just sort of touching on that, we spoke on the first serve about going back about 12 months ago now. And Max's trajectory has been amazing. It's been steady growth. It's been rapid in patches, but just steady for the most part of it. And you flagged on the show that you think he has the potential to be a top 20 player in the world. Personally, I completely agree with you. I think he's got weapons and a massive variety in his game. How difficult was it stopping working with him when, you've got such a connection and you both really believe in the mission and the end goal?
It was challenging. It was, it was a bit of a shock. I thought we were on a wonderful path, and he was ticking all the boxes. So it was a bit of a shame for it to end. I've only recently got over it. I'd have to admit that it took, a couple of months to really reflect on the surprise of that happening. And, I wish him the best. He's a wonderful kid. He's got a beautiful heart, and he, has so many tools to work with. I just think if, he continues to work on himself, that's such a big piece, is the off-court work. And I just think at times it lacks the focus from a lot of players, and that's when they get lost. He certainly puts in the hard work on the court and doing the extra training off the court. It's just ticking those mental boxes. I'd just love to see him continue to do that. He does have the tools now, so hopefully he takes what we worked on and he continues using that in his training and as his growth, for his growth as a player and a person. I'm here if he ever needs me, and as I've said, the Play Awake and the mental stuff is what I think can make the biggest difference and can be the keys that can unlock all the physical stuff that goes on out there.
For sure. And I guess, you speak so fondly of Max, and you guys had an amazing relationship, and we saw it from just the outside looking in.
you know, his growth was immense with when you were working with him. And, you know, he'd come out on court one week and I was watching him. I watched most of his matches last year and it was really cool to see how each tournament you could see he was just adding things to his game. I guess we haven't really touched on, I guess, why the relationship ended, but is there any chance of you guys, do you think, rekindling it going forward and working together in the future?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm open to whatever the future holds and I'll, you know, feel into it, whether it works for me and the family. Obviously, there's a lot of traveling involved, you know, with a professional player, which is challenging for the family. But, you know, I love working with players that really want to, that are really wanting to work and you know, are open. I think we'll see what happens. But yeah, I'm definitely open to it. We did so much work with his serve and volley game, you know, and a lot of movement forward. So hopefully he continues to do that. I think that's just it's his X factor. It's where he can, yeah, really unsettle a lot of opponents. So the grass court season right now really suits him. And, you know, I saw he had some good results in Surbiton. He got through qualies and won a few rounds. So, it'd be nice to see him do well at Wimbledon. I know there's no point. So when I saw that, I was a little bit, you know, almost frustrated for him. I'm sure he's frustrated with that, he loves the grass and it's his shot to really, really attack the rankings. But Wimbledon has no points, so I'm sure he's disappointed with that. But it's just the way the chips have fallen. So he just needs to accept that and move on and just, you know, as we say, just keep getting one day better. That's what Agassi said to me. That's one of his mottos, just one day better. And, you know, I like that one. So
that's a great motto. That can sort of relate to any aspect of life, and especially in professional sport. Nathan, going forward, you're obviously in the States at the moment. You said you plan on coming back to Australia soon. Do you have any goals, I guess, for the short-term future? And do you plan on possibly coaching again on the tour if an opportunity presents itself?
Nothing at the moment. I'm, you know, heading to Europe for a couple of weeks with the family. Just going to spend some time traveling around Europe as a tourist, which I haven't had a chance to do before. And, you know, it's always, you know, airports, hotels and tennis courts. So, you know, now we can do a bit of sightseeing. My kids are 13 and 10. So they're at good ages to, you know, go on a trip to Europe together. And then after that, I'm still open and still open to see what the future presents. And I actually did step back out on court the other day with one of a very promising young girl from Pennsylvania. She's like number one in the state. And she's really into what I'm working on with her, and super open. So we'll see where that goes. But the family at this stage has flights back in September, so we'll probably head back to Australia then, and then just see what presents.
Amazing, Nathan. Just before I let you go, it's sort of a two-part question, but what advice would you give to an aspiring tennis player, and how could a junior or aspiring tennis player, not even a junior, but at any age, get involved with Play Awake? Because I think it's an amazing, method, if you want to call it that, that you've created. And for those who want to get involved, how can they?
Sure. Yeah, so I guess the advice I'd give an aspiring player is to ask questions, is to find a mentor and just ask as many questions as possible. Just and reach out to more than one mentor. And one mentor might come along and you spend a period with them, and then that relationship ends for whatever reason, and then another one. Keep seeking mentors. So I think that's what I'm, that's what I would hit home on. And as far as Play Awake, you can reach out to me at healytennis.com.au, and I'll be more than willing to answer any questions and take players through processes. I do online coaching, so that is an option for players that are looking for that mental edge. And and as I said, I appreciate tennis results, but I'm more in love with the art form of the game and the play. You know, that's where the play came from, is playing with your eyes open, and you're ultimately your heart open, rather than the competitive battlefield and I'm gonna rip this guy's heart out or girl's heart out. It's I experienced it, that it doesn't need to be like that. It's a meditation. We would go through all these meditative processes that on the other side, really can let your tools shine and you can play your best tennis.
No, absolutely love it. I love it. We'll attach all the handles on Instagram so people can get in touch. Nathan, thank you so much for opening up.
That's awesome. Well, I can't wait to hear about what happens in the future, and we're definitely going to catch up again soon. So I'm keen to get an update on what's going on in your life. But Nathan, really appreciate you joining me. It's been an absolute pleasure. We got there in the end with Zoom. We had a few issues, but it's been awesome, and I really appreciate you joining me.
Thanks, Jed. Yeah, me too. And appreciate chatting and reminiscing about the tour and, all the fond memories I have of, being out there and all the gifts that I've been given. I feel like I've lived a very blessed life.
Absolutely. Well, we're definitely going to do it again. We're going to do a part two where we touch on Play Awake, and we're going to dive real deep into that.
Thanks, Jed. Yeah, I look forward to that as well.
Well, that's all we've got for you today. Thank you so much to Nathan Healy for joining me today on Aussies Only. We will definitely be doing a part two with Nathan where we dive deep into Play Awake, so stay tuned for that. Be sure to head back and listen to any previous editions of the show. We've got plenty of guests on Aussies Only, so be sure to listen in to any previous editions of the show. Thank you so much for tuning in to this edition of Aussies Only.
The First Serve is your home of tennis at thefirstserve.com.au. Log on to find out all the details of our live radio show, other podcasts, read weekly features by our team of writers, and follow us on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, and subscribe to our YouTube channel. I'm in it to win it.